instance of the third committee of both houses, the committee from the NCOP had to split because others are members of their finance committee, which is also having a session as we speak at Good Hope. We actually say, the two of us, that some of these things we must just run them jointly because they are the same things. Because the people who are dealing with the fiscal framework, I'm sure, will make the same input when they come to us for public hearings. So we'll have to look into that. Welcome to the FFC. Are you now connected, settled, and ready? You had to exercise a bit this morning. Take the steps. Good for those who don't exercise. That's an opportunity. Madige, welcome to National Treasury. Yeah. We are happy when you are here so you can hear all the issues that are being raised. Welcome to our research team, committee researchers, all support staff, media, journalists, and everybody. I have two apologies at the moment. Honorable Kwankwa from UDM and Honorable Manana are not able to make it. Honorable Manana is consulting a doctor. Honorable Kwankwa attending another meeting. Honorable Ntileni and Honorable Zondi also not able to attend. Okay. Others, welcome, Honorable Members. Yesterday we had an input from the Budget Office on the MTBPS. They also spent a bit of time looking at issues of higher education. We did ask the FFC to also do the same, look at issues around funding of higher education. So, Chairman, I'm sure you have had an opportunity to look into that, so because all members are very interested in that subject. Others, welcome, and the floor is yours. You can introduce your team and make an input. Honourable members, you don't have the documents. Okay, since they are coming. All right, the documents are being distributed. Refreshments are also there if you want to grab something quietly. We're not going to break for refreshments. All right, let me hand over to the FSC to make their presentation.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. My name is Bongani Khumalo from the Financial and Fiscal Commission. I am accompanied by Professor Nico Steitler, who is one of our commissioners and who also happens to be based in one of the public universities. So when we speak about that, I am sure we will be able to understand what a challenge from a university professor is, what has just transpired. I've got next to Professor Steitler, Dr. Mkululi Ncube, who is our program manager for local government. Next to Dr. Ncube is Caleb Dawood. He is our program manager for provincial budgets. And then to my right is Dr. Hamed Amusa, who is the program manager for our public finance and macroeconomics unit. What we will do, Chairperson, is maybe let me start off by saying that we did make a written submission which addresses the broad issues around the medium-term budget policy statement, and also we have included in that the subsequent question that you asked us to do, which was about the funding for public universities. Fortunately, there's been a lot of work that we have done in the past, which we have actually tabled around that particular matter, and we did back in 2011, if I'm not mistaken, a very detailed analysis of the budgets of universities, and at that point we did highlight that the trend that we were observing was that the gap between what universities are getting from the public sector and what they are getting from other sources of income was widening. And to fill up that gap, what was happening was that the fees, student fees, were actually rising to fill up that gap. And if you look at the long-term trends, which is what we did up to 2012, I think the numbers went up to 2012, you would notice a particular trend that showed that the funding to higher education from the state was declining. Also, the funding from the private sector or the debt income stream was also not rising fast enough, and therefore the gap was widening, and therefore the fees were rising at a very fast rate, and we did mention that that could present issues of increasing burden on the students. But we will come back to those issues when we make the detailed presentation. Now, I think it's important for me to provide the background against which this medium-term budget policy statement was formulated. It is basically against the backdrop of an economy that is vulnerable to negative domestic and external factors. And this was something that is also contained in our annual submission for the Division of Revenue 2016-17, which we tabled in May. And I think we briefed this committee around sometime in September, if I'm not mistaken. The low fragile growth is making it difficult to tackle the challenges of high social ills, which are really unemployment, poverty, and inequality. It also leading to fiscal and external imbalances. The rising levels of impatience with deteriorating social conditions has made this one of the toughest MCVPs to craft in a long time. You know, coupled with this, we saw on the day student protests at universities that have culminated in a moratorium on fee increases next year that was not accommodated for at the time of the tabling of the MCBPS or of the crafting of the MCBPS. It basically means that now we have to think about what it is that must be done in order to deal with that kind of a decision. But the public sector's three-year wage agreement, the outcome was also higher than what had been planned. And the gap basically between what the state can accommodate and what the outcome was, we have to be absorbed by the contingency reserve, which also creates its own challenges, because there are other matters that might arise. And if we have nothing in the contingency reserve, then there's a problem. That leaves little over to cater for other unforeseen emergencies. Basically, that's what I'm trying to drive at here. Now, the spending levels are highly constrained and exacerbated by economic shocks to gross fixed capital formation, households, continuing unemployment, and increased levels of poverty and inequities. It is against this background that this MTBPS is made. Now, we're making this in terms of the relevant legislation that I've listed there. Let me just paint the picture of what it is that I've just said. In a picture form, we have that graph there that shows us what has actually happened. And what is interesting is that what is of interest is that blue line. I hope it's blue. Sometimes these colors, they show you something else. It's that blue line and the red dotted line, which basically shows us that what we thought is not what we are actually faced with. And therefore, we have to do something about that. Now, what this budget emphasized, the 2015 budget emphasized fiscal consolidation in response to weaker than expected economic outlook. Now, by the time we get to October 2015, we have an even gloomier situation, which basically means that we have to tighten the belt even faster or tighter. And that is the context that one paints whatever it is that government is trying to do in terms of the policy statement and the reality that against which that those policies must be dealt with. Let me ask Dr. Amusa to then give a bit of details on these particular matters. And then after Dr. Amusa, Chair, with your permission, I will request Mr. Dawood, and then Dr. Nube in that order, and then we will wrap up the presentation.
Thank you, Commissioner Khumalo, honorable members of the committee. As Commissioner Khumalo has just mentioned earlier, we will note that this represents the third consecutive year that South Africa has had to revise its growth forecast downwards. The MTBBS has stated that the growth forecast for this year will be 1.5% and 1.7% in the next year. And these growth projections are in line with what the FSC's own work has done when we did our own modeling back in 2011, where we did a severe, we did three types of scenario planning: moderate, severe, and business as usual. This is still in line with the severe, where we thought that growth in the global economy will be slow, and that would necessitate a slowdown, a feedback into South Africa's economy. So it's in line with our own projections, and also in line with what the IMF has predicted, slightly lower, a bit slightly lower. And most of this is centered around the fact that there are external factors as well as internal dynamics that are impacting on growth. The growth that South Africa has seen over the past 3 years, coming at below 2%, represents the first time in post-democratic South Africa since 1994 that such growth levels have been seen. Apart from the contraction in 2009, these growth levels mimic what happened during before the transition. So you have growth levels that mimic what happened in 1993 and 1992. And this represents a cause of concern when you look at that. Essentially, when you look at what drives the external developments that are impacting on South Africa's growth prospects, the biggest issue that's coming out of that are twofold. The first is that we show a graph there that shows the rand depreciation since 2009. What you observe across a trend line is that it stays within a negative phase, essentially showing that the exchange rate depreciation, the value of the rand has fallen against major currencies and more against the United States dollar, which is where most global commodities are priced in. The effect on that is that we expect normally that when you have a depreciation, it should boost your exports. It makes your locally produced goods much cheaper and makes it more attractive in export markets. But that has come, the depreciation has coincided with slower global economic growth, especially in major economic markets, most notably the Chinese economy, which accounts for 80% of South Africa's commodity exports and accounts for 15% of South Africa's total exports. And this is, what can we do about the Chinese economy? We're limited in that impact because China is essentially shifting away from the investment-driven and import-driven growth that they experienced from the 2000s to the 2011, essentially changing the structure of its economy to be more focused on consumption and the services sector. And in that sense, commodity prices are declining because the demand from China is significantly dropped and is affecting global commodity prices, and that translates to what South Africa is facing. The net effect is that the feedback has an impact on the domestic economy itself. And we see that notably within the mining industry. There's a significant drop in China's exports. As I mentioned earlier, we have 15% of commodity exports are falling. And the currency depreciation has been offset by declining prices. That presents for the mining sector a twofold problem in that it faces falling global demand, and that cannot be offset by the currency depreciation. And we see that in form of the rising tensions that we had earlier in the year that necessitated a business pact, or a pact between government, business, and unions around addressing issues of uncertainty within the mining industry. We're still saddled with a number of infrastructure bottlenecks that can impact on South Africa's growth prospects. The electricity supply constraints are still existing, although they're increasingly being addressed. The issues around small and medium-scale enterprises and growing the sector in order to address the labor surplus issue that we have within the economy, and the need to enhance the efficiency of infrastructure spending across the three spheres of government becomes a more pressing issue when you look at the internal dynamics affecting South Africa's growth prospects. Moving on to what we consider to be the risk to the fiscal framework or the risk to the fiscal outlook, as Commissioner Kumalo has alluded to earlier, the declining, the slowdown in South Africa's economic growth is a limiting factor on government's capacity to carry out a number of its programs, especially around the issue of expanding the tax base, expanding the economy, and growing a position for small and medium-scale enterprises. We face inflationary pressures, although that has been dampened by the fall in oil prices recently, and the weak financial positions of several major public entities comes to the fore. In managing these risks, the Commission has previously made a number of recommendations around these issues, and we simply reemphasize this here. The need to alleviate the power constraints in the short term, you limit delays to the additional generation capacity that comes online, and implementing realistic turnaround plans for your state-owned entities. And we are aware that any manifestation of any of this risk could result in what we term a fiscal slippage from the current precarious fiscal position. In terms of what specific key areas are raised to the fiscal framework, I've stated earlier the state-owned companies, the continuous need for cash injections in a constrained microeconomic environment, impinges on government's budgetary functions and its ability to create fiscal space to address those problems, and also impacts on the developmental role that these entities are meant to play in terms of addressing the infrastructure bottlenecks. We note also that the intention to reform the healthcare and social protection also poses an area of risk, the national health insurance being one, and the possible extension of your social grants system to children of a certain age is also being discussed, and that can have implications for your national and provincial framework. The key one that we've experienced in the past year is that as National Treasury will state, is that the increase in the public sector wage bill has to be accommodated using the contingency reserve. And in essence, that leaves government with little fiscal room to respond to possibilities in revenue shortfalls or need to address unbudgeted spending allocations. I think this year, the big picture is that what will happen if South Africa experiences a drought, and how will government be able to attend to that, given that the fiscal room is already constrained? That's just one example. And the commission, and which Commissioner Kumalo is part of, is working with the Presidential Remuneration Review Commission to look at how best the public sector wage increases can be linked to matters of productivity and increased performance within the public sector as a means of reforming that key area. When you look at how the current economic outlook bodes for South Africa's labor dynamics, we present a picture there where we basically show what has happened in terms of looking at South Africa's GDP and the total employment within the non-agricultural sector. What you find are three distinct eras or phases. The pre-2008 recession, you will observe that total employment, the growth in total employment declined, especially just after the global economic recession. And between 2010 and 2013, when government instituted its counter-cyclical policy to combat or mitigate against the effects of the global economic recession by boosting infrastructure spend, you notice that GDP stabilized and also employment also increased. The growth in employment also stabilized and increased relatively significantly. And what you have in the third era is now that government has embarked on a process of fiscal consolidation, you have a severe decline in your total employment, especially in the non-agricultural sectors. So what this trend begins to speak to are issues around how the fall or the continued downward trend in the growth forecast of South Africa can have an impact on the employment within both the public and the private sector, and what measures can be used to combat this. It also speaks to issues of the rigidity within South Africa's labor market, the issues of skills mismatch in an economy that is going through constraints, and how best it is to address this within the current environment that we have. And addressing these rigidities will need for a greater compact understanding across the different spheres, governments and businesses, on finding a balance between workers' rights and enhancing economic efficiency. And issues around flexibility and decentralization of wage negotiations come to the fore, and regulations also in terms of how you deal with employment creation within small and medium-scale enterprises and how that can impact on the labor surplus, especially in the non-skilled sector of the economy, where unemployment is one of the most significant problems within that sector. other area that we raised is the area of the fiscal, to the fiscal risk, is also in terms of the wage bill challenge. What you have there is an analysis of the growth in government's recurrent expenditures since 2010, 2011, and 2012. What you see there is that there has been an upward trend in the major components of government's recurrent expenditure, compensation of employees, your goods and services, and your payments for capital assets. Although the payments for capital assets has been the fastest rising or has experienced the largest growth, the main component of government's recurrent expenditure still is compensation of employees, which comes in at over 35% of all total spending, recurrent expenditure by the government. And while government had contained this in the years following the recession, in the document, the comprehensive document that we have prepared, we noted that government, the headcount decreased between 2009 and 2013. We also noted that in real terms, the expenditure allocated to catering for public sector wage increases declined. But with the current above inflation increases that has wiped out the contingency reserve, what we're seeing is that in absolute terms, government will have to cater for about 10%. The increase in wage the wage bill is about 10% on average over the next medium term. And the argument is we need to find a way for ensuring the sustainability of the wage bill in order for it not to impact adversely on government's plans to ensure fiscal stability and ensuring that it's able to meet its expenditure ceilings. And in this light, the work of the Commission on enhancing performance and productivity and linking that to public sector remuneration, and also the work of the Presidential Remuneration Review Committee, will be most welcome. We look forward to the work they're going to do in that and what will come of that in addressing that wage bill challenge. With that in mind, Chair, with your permission, I'll hand over to Mr. Ali Dawood to go through the fiscal framework.
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, members. Moving on to the consolidated fiscal framework, which speaks to the money that's in the system and how that money is actually allocated. We know that the macroeconomic outlook projects weaker revenue and higher debt services, which essentially imposes costs on the overall fiscal framework that the government tabled in the 2015 MTPBS. Despite this, what we find is that the government is planning to spend 3 trillion rand over the next 3 years, relative to the revenue envelope of 3.7 trillion. So there's a gap between the spending of government and the revenue that is based, that is going to be generating over the 3 years. And that gap is being made up through debt services, which government needs to secure in order to fund the expenditure. Now, when we look at the expenditure over the MTF period, we see that in real terms, despite the weak economic environment, it's still projected to increase by 2.6%. However, a marginally stronger growth of 3% is projected for revenue. So what we see is that the revenue is actually growing at a faster rate than expenditure, which means that your debt-to-GDP ratio is going to decline over the MTF period. Now, this 3% growth in revenue is underpinned by certain tax reforms and certain tax proposals that were made in the 2015 MTPBS. Now, with respect to the expenditure, the bulk of the expenditures being allocated to the equitable share as well as the conditional grants funding to provincial as well as local spheres. Now, moving on to the division of the revenue, once we remove the national debt from the fiscal framework, what essentially remains is 1.2 trillion rand to be shared among the three spheres of government in 2016-2017. And that table there indicates the split between the three spheres over the MTF period. So we see there that the bulk of the resources are allocated to your national as well as your provincial spheres. And then local government receives 107 billion rand in 2016-17. However, what is interesting to note in the division of revenue is that consistent with the historical pattern allocations or the real increase to local government grows by the fastest amount. So you'll see there that local government allocations increase by 3.5% compared to national allocations of 2.3% your provincial allocations of 2.3% and your national allocations of 1.2%. So if we look at in terms of how the funding is being, the growth in funding is taking place, we see that the bulk of the growth is happening in your sub-national government. And with specific reference to provincial allocations, that 2.3% is largely a result of your wage increases in your health and your education, which is labor-intensive at the provincial level. Now moving on to the next slide, which is your unallocated resources or your contingency reserve, which we referred to early on. What we essentially did here in this table is to look at what the projections of the contingency reserve was in the budget for a particular year compared to the MTBPS in a particular year in three financial year. So we looked at 2013-14, 14-15, and then we looked at this financial year as well. And what we saw is, what we have observed is that there's a consistent pattern that come 2015 MTPBS, there's been significant drawdowns to the allocated, to the contingency reserve, largely to fund wage increases that have been negotiated. And consistent with historical trends, we see that there are cuts in 2016-17 and 17-18 compared to what we saw in the budget 2015. In budget 2015, we saw that the contingency reserve was 15 billion rand and 45 billion rand respectively in 16-17 and 17-18. And in this MTPBS, we see that those figures have been slashed to 9 billion rand and 15 billion rand respectively to account for those wage increases. Now, the purpose of the contingency reserve, as was mentioned earlier, is to take account of unforeseen and unavoidable situation. And essentially, by depleting it through weaknesses in the wage bargaining arrangement, we essentially remove the fiscal buffer that is required in an unstable economic environment. Moving on to the next slide, which looks at the expenditure by economic classification. And here we essentially look at how resources are being allocated across our different line items. So, for example, compensation, goods and services, your transfers and subsidies and payments for capital assets. And I think the message that we were trying to drive home comes out much more clearly in this slide. And if you see there that the real average annual growth rate for compensation of employees is 3% over the MTF period, which is far larger than any of the other line items that is there in the table. Now, in an effort to strengthen the link between performance and pay, the Commission just calls, I'd like to reiterate the recommendation that we made in the 2016-17 Division of Revenue, which called for a framework for measuring productivity as a first step to benchmark improvements in the public sector over time. Okay, moving on to the section on expenditure prioritization. And we know that close to 50% of the non-interest expenditure that is raised by government gets allocated to health, education, and social protection or your social grants. And what we see here is that compared to the 2.1% real increase in the total government expenditure, education and health is growing by a faster rate. So government is This indicates that government is prioritizing stronger towards education and health, where social protection is growing at an average real rate of 1.9%. So still growing positively, although at a much lower rate. What is crucial to keep in mind is that for the 2016 budget and years where the potential trade-off could potentially be made is between your investment expenditure and your consumption expenditure. And in order for government to drive job creation as well as to drive economic growth, it's important for government to emphasize spending in areas of infrastructure as well as industrial development. Moving on to the next slide, which looks at expenditure prioritization in housing development and municipal infrastructure, a number of key issues that we'd like to highlight here. Firstly, government took a decision to assign housing functions to metros in around 2013. And a special grant was created in 2014-15 that was called the Municipal Human Settlements Capacity Grant to allow for this assignment to take place, to facilitate the assignment to the six metros. Now, a concern for the Commission is that this particular grant was stopped in July 2014 and released in March 2015. Hence spending of only 8.5% of the allocated funds. The Commission is of the view that this undermines the credibility of the Division of Revenue process. And here, something that the Commission raised in its response to the 2014 Division of Revenue Bill, when that particular grant was established, was that the grant should be underpinned by proper planning as well as implementation. Now, the allocation for the human settlements and municipal infrastructure will grow at an annual rate of 7.6%, that's in nominal terms, but it's still higher than, still grows positively if we look at real growth. The Commission welcomes this growth as it indicates government's commitment to invest in basic infrastructure. And it maintains its previous position that the current approach to funding of housing delivery is fiscally unsustainable and needs to be reviewed with a view of promoting active citizenry as well as self-built housing initiatives. Moving to the next slide that looks at the issues of health. Here we just like to speak to two specific issues. The first one is that there has been proposed changes to the indirect component of the National Health Grant, which is funding the HBV virus. Now, initially, the intention was that this grant, after a period of 2 years, was going to be phased into the PES. Which was going to come to an end in 2015-16, and phase into the PES from next year, 2016-17. But what has happened is that this indirect grant has been extended for another 2 years for provinces to develop capacity to develop administrative capacity to implement this particular grant. And then it will be converted to a direct grant after a period of 2 years. So here we also like to emphasize that once again the issue of proper planning may not have been followed in terms of thinking through the evolution of this particular grant. Moving on to the comprehensive HIV grant, what we would like to raise here is that the scope of this particular grant has been expanded to include tuberculosis as well. Now, this has consistently been one of the larger grants in the system. Now, the Commission is of the view that including TB in the grant is not necessarily a problem, except if it is going to displaced the regional intention of the grant. And it's something to keep a close eye on going forward. Now moving on to the next slide, which looks at basic education. Now, with respect to basic education, we find that there are two grants that focuses closely on infrastructure-related activities. And what government is proposing is that in 2016-17, those two grants merge. And this is in line with previous recommendation by the Commission, which highlighted the need to improve efficiency and effectiveness in the system by combining grants that have a similar objective. However, the Commission would just like to raise the issue that merging grants due to non-performance is not necessarily a solution for the causes of causes for non-performance need to be investigated and addressed. So while we are merging the two grants, we still need to identify what exactly are the causes of the underperformance of some of, these grants and try to address that, because merging the two grants is not going to solve the problem. Okay, the Commission also welcomes the review of the National School Nutrition Program, given the misalignment between the provincial as well as the National School Quartile Classification. And here we just like to emphasize the program needs to meet the minimum requirements in providing meals to all learners in national quartiles 1 to 3 for both primary as well as secondary schools as per the national norms and standards for funding, for school funding. Now, Chairperson, moving on to the next section, which speaks to the issue that you requested us to look at, which is related to higher education and training as well as the recent developments. Now, when we look at the fiscal framework for MTPPS 2015, we see that it poses a challenge in terms of addressing government's resolution to implement the 0% fee increase in 2016. Now, essentially, there are short-term implications and then there are long-term considerations as well. The short-term implications is how do we respond to the 0% increase for 2016, and the longer-term considerations relate to looking at broader issues of pre-tertiary education. With respect to looking at the short-term considerations, the issue revolves around how do we find the resources to respond to the 2.5 billion to 4 billion rand shortfall that the zero fee increase will result in. And those figures have just been circulating, so we're using those figures as a rough guideline. Now, there are a couple of options that that face government and the government can explore with respect to this sort of short-term consideration. Option A is that the university for universities to reduce the expenditure. But the downside is that this could lead to a compromise in terms of quality of education, less maintenance work at institutions, and as well as less funding for research activities. And therefore, this is not a desirable option on its own. Option B is that the state to intervene with financing. And here, there are a number of steps that we have highlighted. The first step is that the government could decide to reprioritize within the Department of Higher Education Training budget itself, and thereafter more broadly across government. The second step is to utilize the unallocated reserves or the contingency reserve. However, as we have seen early on, due to the higher than anticipated wage bargaining agreements, the contingency reserve has been depleted compared to what was projected in 2015 budget. So what is left for 2016-17 is 2.5 billion rand. So government could potentially use part of that contingency reserve to cover the shortfall in the to make up the shortfall in student fees. However, this of course will mean that this will result in a lower buffer in case fiscal risk in terms of if there is a natural disaster. The third option that we highlighted is that there could be the sale of state assets. And there is a precedent for this, which the committee will recall, which was the sale of 23 billion in equity, sale of assets to fund the 23 billion in equity injection in Eskom. The downside of this option is that once you sell off the assets, it can't be reused again to rebalance your expenditure in future years. Sub-option 1, together with universities exercising greater fiscal austerity, would, in the view of the Commission, set the example for private sector to respond. So the Commission's view is that we should look at the combination of the different approaches. Government should partly finance, but the university should also look at how it can also come to the table to assist with closing the gap. Now, if we look at the long-term considerations, and this revolves around the provision of free education and tertiary institutions, this requires a significant amount of additional funding. And here there are four funding streams or funding areas that government could tap into in order to fund this particular policy objective. Government can either, firstly, reprioritize state funding. Second, committed implementation of plans to sell off non-strategic assets. Third, increasing the tax burden. And fourth, it can go out and borrow to finance this. Of course, the other option, obviously, is if the economy grows, tax revenues will increase. That would be the ideal solution. But in the absence of that, then these four areas need to be considered. Now, the implementation of each of these reforms requires a substantive amount of research, which the recently formed commission would need to take into consideration. Now, the commission has done previous work looking at the issue of higher education in 2012, and that work that we did alluded to some of the challenges that we are currently experiencing at the moment. Some of the issues that we highlighted in that research was that the funding framework underpinning universities is in dire need of differentiation. Also, there are a few other issues that we highlighted in this research. Going to the next slide. And here is that besides the issue of fees confronting universities, there are also other priorities confronting departments of higher education and training as well. First is the issue of your colleges such as your TVET or previously referred to as your FET colleges, as well as your community education colleges that have historically been underfunded. And your FET colleges went through a function shift from provincial to national. And the main reason for that was essentially to make sure that those TVET colleges are given adequate prioritization. Now, the Commission supports the task team that has been set up to review the funding model underpinning the existing higher university fees. However, the task team should consider the broader system which the university finds itself in, and avoid the situation where shifting of high fees in one part of the system leads to pressures in another part. A further issue that we'd like to emphasize is the need for clear differentiation in the determination of free education and clarity in terms of government's response around the precise definition of free education should be determined. And then Chairperson, moving on to the last slide that looks at expenditure prioritization. And here what we find is that in the MTPPS over the MTS period, allocations to job creation, labor and social security funds are essentially not growing in real terms. Stay minus 0.1%. Now this lack of growth could put increased pressure on our social services. And something that the Commission would just like to emphasize is that when we look at some of job creation programs such as your public employment programs, it should not be looked at as jobs being created in the public sector, but rather as a means to improve labor market outcomes. Here at this point, I'd like to move my colleague, Dr. Mkuli, will take over and complete the rest of the presentation.
Thank you. The next slide look at the what is happening to the local government sector vis-a-vis the MTPPS. What we see from the MTPPS is that there is an increase in the allocation to the local government sector, which is a welcome development considering that there's a lot to be done there in terms of eradicating backlogs and also providing basic services. So on average and in real terms, total allocations to the local government sector will increase by 3.5% between 2016-17 to 2018-19. That's the welcome development. And going to the next slide there, the Commission welcomes the additional resources, especially to the local government's equitable share. There is an increase in resources being allocated through that particular instrument. These allocations will increase from 41.6 billion in 2014-15 to 51.7 billion in 2015-16, and they are expected to grow further in the outer years. What is worrying for the Commission in this is that the LES in the outer years is actually going to grow far less than the growth in the cost of basic services, which means that most municipalities have to absorb the cost of these increases in bulk services like electricity and bulk water because the LES is not growing fast enough. Then going to conditional grants, we see also an increase in the allocation, and I think that's where there is the fastest growth in terms of what goes to the local government sector. But in line with the Commission's previous observations that indirect grants are proliferating and their performance is weak, especially looking at our recent submission. But we see that, especially if you look at the graph, the lower graph, the blue one, you'll see that the baseline to indirect grants is declining there. The baseline changes to indirect grants are declining, which is a welcome development. It indicates some consolidation of grants, which is in line with what the Commission has pronounced before, that there's a need to consolidate, to move away from indirect to direct grants. So it's a welcome development. Then the next slide, we look at what the MTPPS alluded to under infrastructure grant reviews. So it's part of the Commission is part of this particular reviews, which are partly informed by the Commission's 2011 review of the local government fiscal framework. And the Commission, in this particular light of these grant reviews, welcomes what the MTPPS has pronounced, especially the measure of multiple water and sanitation grants. It's a welcome move, the consolidation which the Commission has pronounced over and over that there's a need to consolidate some grants. If you look at water, for example, districts were getting streams of funding from different sources. They were getting money from the MIG, Rural Household Infrastructure Grant, the Municipal Water Infrastructure Grant, etc. So it increased the problem of reporting, problems of administrative efficiencies.
So this is a welcome development, and also the introduction of a formula-driven public transport network plan. It introduces the issue of predictability and transparency if we use a formula, and the introduction of greater differentiation for secondary cities and creating mixed cities is welcome. And also, as I pointed out, that grants are proliferating. The merging of urban grants is also a welcome development, as well as the amendments which are being proposed on the MIG, which will allow funds to be used for maintenance and refurbishment. That's an area which was really lacking in the municipal space. So these particular reforms, on the whole, they will enhance administrative efficiency and reporting. They will see municipalities pay more attention to the issue of asset care and maintenance, and they will introduce predictability and transparency into the whole grant scheme. Then the other issue, which there are a couple of issues which we also looked at. The earliest withdrawal, which was pronounced also, there's mention of that in the MTPPS. We know that many municipalities have persistently not complied with measures which are in the Constitution, especially the 30-day payment rule. We alluded to this some time ago. And National Treasury has to take some punitive measures in the form of stopping the LES for those municipalities which were owing to ESCOM and water boards. If we look at the MTPPS, it's not that there is some intervention from different departments, especially in terms of assisting these municipalities pay. Then one of the notable interventions is that there is some assistance in assisting these municipalities enter into agreements with ESCOM payment agreements. But the commission on that one, agreements have been entered into, but what is of concern to the commission is that many municipalities have not these agreements. And to that end, the commission encourages municipalities to take their fiduciary responsibilities seriously so that to honor their debt. The other issue which we looked at in light of the MTPPS is the boundary redeterminations. On that one, the commission welcomes the MTPPS proposals to grant each major risk demarcation an allocation in the 2016 budget. We saw that those demarcations which were done in 2013, there was an allocation of 139 million to assist municipalities which were facing some costs related to the demarcation. So there's a welcome development in the 2016 budget that they'll be provided with additional resources, those which will be redetermined effective 2016 local government elections. But the commission recommends that an objective full financial impact of the demarcation to be determined, and that the receiving municipalities is made fully aware of the cost of receiving other municipalities. The commission welcomes the spirit of differentiation embraced in the grant, the transitional grant. But the commission also encourages provincial treasuries and COFTA to closely monitor these grants to ensure that the resources which are related to the redeterminations are used strictly to defray the costs which are related to demarcations and nothing else. On the next two slides, we review actual spending in different government departments. We start with the issue of expenditure smoothing, which implies that there must be some uniform expenditure right across the year. That is ideal. What is wanted, that we think by September, government departments will have spent at least 50% of their main budget. That is in an ideal situation if we look at expenditure smoothing. But we know that in reality this will be different depending on whether it is recurrent or capital expenditure. But we're looking at this for government departments as a whole. What we highlight in our document is that spending performance has generally improved compared to 2014-15 in many government departments. Spending by all votes and transfers to the PF is in line with the assumed norm of 50%. But if we look deeper into that, so notwithstanding the overall positive performance, if we assess the individual departmental performance, there is an uneven picture which we observe. On the one hand, there are certain departments which have far exceeded that particular norm that by September, we expect in an ideal environment they should have spent about 50% of their allocations. But if we look at higher education and training, for example, they have spent 70%, they have spent about 70% of its budget. Whereas if you look at the public works, rural development and land reform, and water and sanitation departments have recorded spending rates of below 40%. So there is some wide variation in that. Excessive deviations below or above the norm is undesirable from an expenditure smoothing perspective, and that departments should attempt to remain within the confines of spending performance guidelines. Then my last slide is on adjustment estimates. We see from the MTPPS that declared unspent funds amounted to $3.18 billion, which the bulk of these funds, they relate to underspending by national departments. And the adjustment budget met provision amounting to $1.6 billion for rollovers, and these, unlike in previous years, the rollovers amount has increased, whilst the number of departments reporting these rollovers has actually declined. But we note the Department of Cooperative Governance, which is dominating the rollovers with over $1.5 billion approved in the adjustment budget. But these rollover funds for this particular department are for the local government equitable share for municipalities to pay Eskom and the water board accounts. With that, I'll hand over to you, Prof, to conclude.
After a long presentation, let me be very quick. The big question really is, how do you reignite growth so that the fiscal picture looks better? From a fiscal point of view, obviously there's a number of policy issues that was alluded right up at the beginning by Dr. Amusa. What can the fiscus do? Policy has been to increase expenditure on education, to increase the skills base necessary for a growing economy, to keep a social safety net spending up to present levels, and of course to increase productivity in the public infrastructure, both in the personnel as well as in the built environment. But what we can see is, and which causes some concern for the FFC, is that funding on higher education has actually been declining, and that's reported in 2012 already, that there's a reduction in effort on infrastructure-led growth that we are perceiving, increased wage bill without real productivity gains, and that then the last word of caution is then if in fact the belt is being tightened, as the minister said, and cost is trying to be contained on personnel, that it does not come here at the expense of critical areas where skills and leadership in the public service is required. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. You have any further comments, Chair? No?
That sounds okay. I'd say that I might have to shift in the middle of this. I need to go and brief the Standing Committee on Finance as well.
Okay.
And that's fine.
That's why we should have made the joint check assembly check session.
No, thanks. Thanks very much for the presentation, honourable members. The FSC has tabled its analysis, very comprehensive, touching on areas spelled out by the minister in tabling the MTPS. So I'll welcome you, members, to comment the presentation by the FSC. Okay, that's the first hand, the second hand, the third hand. Can we start with the three hands?
Thank you, Chair. Let me welcome the report. Although I must admit what we've heard today is what FFC has repeatedly told us previously, and I must thank you for identifying all the challenges that we face and being very upfront and honest about it and telling us so that we can find solutions together. I'd like you to comment on the issue of that, the higher education, because my understanding is this, that we are only going to budget to allocate in the next financial year end, not in this one, for this zero fee increase thing. So apparently it's not really impact on the present one. One very important question I want to ask. You say that you've always made recommendations and things, and you highlighted some very pertinent issues here in my understanding. And you've been doing this over a period of time. I'd like you to tell us those recommendations that you're making. Is that being welcomed? Is there any of your recommendations being implemented? And maybe if you can give us some examples so we can actually see, you know, whether you are being taken seriously in identifying some of these challenges that we are experiencing and finding solutions. Because you talk about some of the challenges we have in terms of improving, we talk about oversight, we talk about performance of local government, but year in and year out, we are identifying the same things. We have the same problem. You're making the recommendation. You have your findings. People are not performing. There's no consequences. It goes on and on and on. So all we're doing is we're identifying them. We're making recommendations. I'm not sure whether it's been taken seriously or not. And that's why it seems to be getting progressively worse over a period of time until, of course, we're going to reach resolution. We talk about selling, and my fear here is that whenever a need arises to want to spend on a specific that has not been allocated for, my fear about talking about selling state-owned entities or assets is that that is a temporary measure. And I'm going to give you a good example. We heard yesterday how we sold Vodacom, valuable Vodacom shares to monies for Eskom. Now, that Vodacom shares was bringing us income, and like you said, that income is not going to come in anymore. Now, I want you to also comment on, and I'm not sure whether you're going to be able to do this, because I know this eye and ears all over. A lot of our state-owned entities are giving us serious challenges. I mean, I've been told that if South African Airways reduces its manpower by 50%, it will still function the way they are. So it means we've doubled our... We have just have too many employees there, but we cannot take, we just don't have the guts, the courage, the conviction to go out there and say, let's tighten the belts. Now, should we not be getting rid of state-owned assets or selling state-owned entities to the private sector if we believe they're not performing, because we have to continuously bail them out year in and year out? So some of them are really no benefit to us, rather than selling valuable assets, and that is my concern. I'd like us to retain them for the purposes of income and revenue that we would have. What is frightening for me is that you know, projections, you talk about the revenue, and I think we're talking about something like about a few hundred billion rand that is going to be the shortfall between our revenue and our expenses over the next 3 years. Again, it means the borrowing is going to increase, and I'm worried whether we're coming back to that a limit that we were setting ourselves in terms of how much we are going to be in debt in terms of our GDP. So it means that it's now going to get uncontrollably out of hand to come to a stage where we're going to reach a fiscal cliff. We must be honest, if you're spending 10 rand and you're getting 5 rand, you're going to reach a problem. So for me, that is also a serious problem. I want you to also tell me, in terms of the projections we tend to make and these forecasts, and more often than not, you find that it's not in line with actual performance. So we under-allocate and things, and then we run into trouble. What is your opinion on that? What do you think we should do about it differently? And I know there's too many questions. My other fear is the issue of the high wage. And I want you to be honest and tell us, do you think there's too much of a challenge for government right now, too much of pressure, because the labor market, people are demanding high salaries, the unions are putting pressure, and you can see at what rate our high will, and yet the output is not in line with what we are paying. And where is it actually going to be taking us if we're going to continue? There is really, and I agree with you, industrial development and infrastructure development is paramount for the success and for economic development. It's not happening. I hear it talk, but really nothing is happening. What do you suggest we should do? I mean, you know, we bring it out repeatedly. Who doesn't know we need to create jobs? There's too much of emphasis on government for me to give this. Government must do this. Government must do that. Government must give grants. But a lot more should come from the private sector. What are we doing to actually to increase that so that we can create more jobs and again develop the economy? But it's again, for me, a problem, because I think the emphasis is too much. I like what you're saying about the housing, and yes, I think you've identified that before. Why should we be giving everybody free housing? Why should everybody believe it's an entitlement? And that private-public sector discussion, I think that we've had previously, where people that could afford 500 and 1,000 rand a month, let's give them site service sites, or let's so that they can have their own houses, they can pay, because when you pay, you own it. If you get it for nothing, that's why you find people are selling houses for 5,000 and 10,000 and 20,000. That's what they sell them for. And again, there we have a problem, because we don't have an asset register to see, I gave you a house 5 years ago or 10 years ago, are you still living in that house? No, we don't have that situation. So it's the same thing with education and the funding, the NSS funding, the grants, the loans are not coming in. People are not paying. Again, are we giving it to the skills we need in the country, or are we just giving it because people want it? It's like a fashion to go to university. Now everybody wants to go. When you give free education, I can promise you everybody's going to want to go. It's a problem. So if you can guide us, and I'm asking for this because I know you've identified a lot, and I can see the expertise is there, the knowledge is there, but guide us together. Let us get forward and see how we can find the solution. Chair, I'm going to stop there for now. But if there's an opportunity, we can come back. Thank you.
Thanks, Honorable Imam. You are quite comfortable. I allow you to raise your questions without any hindrance. Thanks. Dr. Kafi.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. So now we've received this report from the Financial Fiscal Commission. Clearly, the country is leading to probably a fiscal cliff, and we need to make some important decisions. I think we need to stop believing that we can continue as we are without making some important decisions. So the information is brought to us, and I think we need to start taking this information to Parliament so that Parliament can make those important decisions. So, this is some information that I would like you to comment on, and obviously some information for clarity. We received a report that the economic growth, or the GDP growth, is 1.7 from Treasury, and then we also received it from the IMF that growth is 1.3%. Can I just hear your views on this? Because you're the expert, as my colleague has said. So what is your analysis as to the forecast of our economy next year? You see, because without accurate forecasts, it's impossible to make important decisions. And I'm raising this point because on one of your slides, it's noted that the IMF forecast seems to be more realistic than Treasury's forecast. So I'll just make your comment on that, and one of your slides does allude to that. When the chairperson of the FFC and the CEO, he was then, both positions, presented to us, we were told that this is the worst scenario. It was difficult to craft this MTBS. And now we again that it is it's the toughest MTBS to craft. In your view, are we going to hear the same story next year that is going to be the toughest? The point I'm wanting to make is that is there hope, and what is that hope? That is the question that I'm asking, and I'm serious about that, because you see, it's good to be positive, but we also need to be realistic. So if you don't have the accurate information or the reliable information, then it's going to be more difficult. And we're in this together, but we can only make those decisions if we have the accurate information. That's the reason why I'm making the statement. We are relying on China for exporting, and it is indicated that the exports are going down. Can I just ask then, we also obviously, we have a dual relationship, so therefore we also import. Has the imports from China also decreased at that same rate? Because clearly, you know, you have the bilateral agreement where you buy from me, I buy from you. So the fact that they're not buying from us, have we then also decreased buying from them? So the question is, has the imports decreased as well? My colleague has alluded to, well, has raised this point about the weakness of the balance sheets in the state-owned equities, companies. And I don't see a recommendation there, and I would want to agree with him, and I know he raised the point. He's a bit radical. He wants to sell everything. That might not work. But to what extent should we consider private-public partnerships? Because I believe that, in my view, that would be the way to go. But obviously, you need to draw a balance as to what extent you should go. So can we just get a recommendation on that, please? The last year, we were excited at the beginning of the financial year about the counter-cyclical policy. It seems as though now that policy has been not been used anymore. Because the downside of that is that now less money is coming into the economy. So what would you recommend? Because I see it's mentioned there, but should we continue? Should we reinstate that counter-cyclical policy? Or are we still implementing it? Or what is your view on or your stance on that? Now, the other one that is a serious matter, you know, when you have reserves, it's good and well you can use the reserves because you've got a situation that which is called an emergency situation. Or, in my view, reserves should be used for accidental unplanned expenditure. Okay, the wage bill could have been partly unplanned, the increase, because I know there was the agreement was 10.1%. But what is going to happen in the future? Because now the reserves are being depleted substantially. So eventually we're going to not have reserves. And those reserves could have been used, for example, for the current education crisis that we have. But now there's nothing. It's going to be depleted to nearly nothing. So what is going to happen after that? Because I can't see, unless you reduce the numbers substantially, I can't see the wage bill decreasing at a rapid rate. Just a clarification here. Dawood indicated that we're going to spend 4.3 trillion rand in the MTBS, but if I recall in the MTBS, the minister, he indicated that it's 4.7 trillion, so I don't know if that was just an error. It's irrelevant, but I mean, it's a big figure, and that's why I'm just asking for what is the actual figure that is going to be spent. Is it 4.3 or 4.7? You see, when you say 0.7, it seems like it's nothing, but 0.4 trillion, then, is a lot of money. I'm nearly done, Honorable Chair. The issue regarding the recommendations to higher education, I see there's a few recommendations, quite a few, and it, some of them are scary. The one on slide 23 is there's an indication of increasing taxes and that. You see, the problem with increasing taxes, it can't be a solution. It cannot be to the already burdened taxpayer, because now the disposable income that is supposed to stimulate the economy is being diminished. So that is actually a very harsh solution. But I understand. I understand that there must be solutions. But the tax issue concerns me. So I just, you know, would like to come up with, and it might not be enough, but there should be another alternative. Okay, so those ones that have been proposed look a bit harsh to the already burdened taxpayers. And then I've got... Yes, one more. Just one more, Honourable Chairperson. One of the easy ways of decreasing the budget deficit is to increase the revenue, but we know it's difficult. But surely that is where one should look at. If not, then perhaps we should look at cutting expenditure. And maybe that's some sort of a recommendation that we should receive from the Commission, because otherwise we are going to be in serious trouble. And that's all that I have. Thanks, Honourable Chairperson.
Thanks, Honourable Fik. Honourable Mdara.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks to the FFT for the presentation. I just have a few questions. The first question is related to the merging of grants. We have said that there's a lot of grants, and you've highlighted it, that municipalities, for example, get many, many streams of grants. And I think, and I want to agree with you that merging them due to non-performance is not going to create a better situation. It's the same as changing boundaries of municipalities. If you put a performing municipality with an unsustainable municipality, you're not going to get a rosy picture out of that. But I think what we had said was that when we merge grants, it's so that we minimize the duplication, because the many, many streams, everybody does their own thing. In essence, it's supposed to holistically change the picture of what happens in a municipality, but it doesn't. So if we look at the grants and merge them to minimize duplication, but also so that in line with the reprioritization, and if that has happened, as opposed to merging them due to non-performance. Maybe if you can comment on that. The other is, you are saying on the issue of higher education. On the issue of higher education, one of your recommendations is that the Department of Higher Education itself must reprioritize. And if they do reprioritize, what or how much do you think possibly can be raised within the department? And when you say reprioritize, have you made recommendations on reprioritizing on what? If also the Department of Higher Education must reprioritize, shouldn't universities also then reprioritize what they are spending on? Not necessarily cut down, because here you are making an assertion that they will stop spending on research, on maintenance, and that sort of thing. And I don't think that's what we're saying. We want to say that universities must equally reprioritize what they are spending on. And if everybody must tighten belts, universities equally should tighten belts. Because something that came up yesterday was that, are universities necessarily producing to boost the economy or stimulate the economy or in line with what the country's needs are? Also, added to that, have we done any research or quantification of what it costs to educate one student or one learner through a higher education system, just up to first degree level or undergraduate level? What is the actual cost and what are the cost drivers? Because the variances between, of course it might change or be different between universities, but the variances across universities are huge. So what is the quantification of what is the cost of educating a student up to undergraduate level? We noted when we did, as a committee, when we did oversight one of the challenges that we came across was the cross the municipal boundaries. The challenge that we found with municipal boundaries was that municipal boundaries are not necessarily in line, or they cross with tribal boundaries as well, and that hampers how municipalities are able to spend grants or deliver services. Have you also picked up this challenge? What do you recommend in relation to that? You also note that the increase in conditional grants and the growth, and you say that it's good, but has the growth and increase in conditional grants matched desired outcomes? Because you can increase the conditional grant. Are you increasing the delivery of service or the outcome per se? In your view, what is the reasonable level of reserve funds given the current economic and social climate? What would be reasonable or desirable? And I think maybe... Okay. For provinces, the pressing need is to cover higher compensation costs of employees. And I think all of us have noticed that. But have you assessed the staff categories that are contributing to the increasing employee compensation? Provinces are mostly burdened with that, but which categories are they falling under? Have you been able to locate which categories they are falling under? And then National Treasury's decision to withhold municipal equitable shares or from some municipalities. What lessons were learned from that, from those that have complied, and if we can duplicate what has happened with municipalities, provinces, I think really provincial treasuries and COGTA have to be more involved in the process of monitoring the spending of municipalities in their provinces, and is that necessarily happening? Bearing in mind you've noted that some municipalities have reneged on their agreements, or let me say not adhered to their agreements, but those municipalities that have, and has it worked, and was it necessary or not necessary at the time when it was a decision by National Treasury, but what lessons have we learned from that process? Thanks, Chair.
Thanks. I want to allow the chair of the commission, if he wants to respond, first, so that on the few questions, I'll allow members further to deal with the issue.
Thank you, Chair. I was just putting down a note for you to say, can I just respond to these questions, and then I will leave the rest of the team here to deal with what I will not have covered. But I think there are important questions that have been raised, which some of them are related. Now, I want to start with the issue of the higher education and training issue and how we respond. I think the primary thing is to protect the credibility of the budget. And so, given that you have given a signal that this is where you are going in terms of your policy position, I'm going to come back to that issue, because we must actually deal with the issue of the fiscal cliff and whether the fiscal policy stance or direction that this MTBPS presents deviates in any way from what we had when the response to the global economic crisis had to be put in place. I think it's important that we actually start from there. But let me deal with this issue of higher education and training. This is a matter that arose, and Honorable, you asking me about the recommendation and their implementation and whether they are taken seriously. The issue that I must say in respect of this issue on higher education and training is that we came here to Parliament and tabled those recommendations. And by the way, the Commission makes recommendations to Parliament and the legislatures. The executive responds to those recommendations of the Commission. And I remember that I, in a very direct way, indicated that one of the things that have happened here is that the response that we have now deals with matters that directly apply to the Division of Revenue, indirectly apply, and those that are considered not to be applicable to the Division of Revenue are not responded to. Now, I will tell you that I did say that those recommendations on the funding of higher education were not responded to in that particular year. So Parliament would have been, from where I sit, would have been the ones to deal with that particular matter at that particular point to be able to be able to ask about whether your recommendations are taken seriously. So it would, from where I sit, it would have been Parliament's responsibility to deal with that in direct communication with the relevant executive for whom those recommendations were made. So I would actually say this is where we are at. Now, in terms of the process now and why it makes sense to say that it was not budgeted for in the current year, where we are going, 2016, because we work on a three-year cycle. So if we accept that 3 year cycle has to be respected, what we need to do is to then find a solution for this year that we're going into, and then we look at the longer-term solution going forward. So why we then make these different options that we put there? We know that in terms of the MTEF process, there are guidelines that are issued to every department and every body who must actually bid for money from the fiscal. So everybody has that, including universities. I am sure that they know that when it's a MTEF process time, they also have to do some numbers and say, no, this is what we will need. So if the response to the economic crisis from the state side was let's exercise restraint, let's apply cost containment measures, let's not grow our budgets by beyond this much, and then somebody decides not to look at it that way and does it another way, obviously we must deal with those incentives that are actually there that allow those people to behave in that particular way. So what we are saying is the first option that you must consider is that the department itself must reprioritize. I don't know what they will reprioritize. There's a couple of issues that they deal with. For example, I sometimes look at annual reports from the CETAs, all of those fall under that within that sphere. And there's a lot of money that goes around unspent. There's also a lot of money that goes around as wasted or whatever. So it's all of those things that are within the efficiency improvements within the department and reprioritization. If we have budgeted money for skills development and training and then we don't actually embark on that in that particular, let's deal with it somehow. So I cannot tell you exactly how much you can get, but I can say that that needs to happen. That's the first port of call. You can then say, what are the universities doing? And I'm not in any way implying that if universities do certain things, then they will reduce their spending on this, so it will impact on quality education. I am sure that universities can also look at their own situations and come to the party. In fact, if one had to punish anybody who came in with a 10%, because if you look at it, you look at the averages. On average, what is the increase that a typical university was looking for in the form of fees? What is the average? So if you look at those gaps, then there must be something that we don't know that is happening in the sector. So how do we deal with those types of differences? we can say, we can give you this much, this is how much the state will be able to give you. The rest, find it. Now, what you guarantee is what you thought everybody must ordinarily should have grown their bushes. So there are those issues that need to be dealt with. And so I'm saying we are not saying this option or that option. And coming to the issues around taxation, that's the only way that government can make money. And it's the easiest. The easiest is borrowing, by the way. But do you want to borrow? If you can, because it's about who benefits from this. Transfer the debt to future generations so that these are options that are available. And we are not saying that we prefer, but what we are saying for now is that we prefer for this money to be found within the current framework that we have for 2016. Then, because there's a committee that is already working on this matter, one should not then deal with this issue in isolation from the other issues. I mean, there are matters that relate to student debt. So some students, there's no increase, okay, fine. But they must still write their exams. They go back to the university, they write their exams. But if they haven't paid, they're not going to graduate. So it's pointless. And so we need to deal with it in a very comprehensive, holistic way rather than just focus on the one issue, which is just the moratorium on the So it's a bigger issue which cannot be dealt with in its entirety at this particular point in time. But we have to make a contingency arrangement to deal with the decision that has already been taken. And why we're saying that the state basically must take the lead, it's because this is a decision that has been taken by the state. So the state will take the lead, and then everybody else who is a player, they must come to that party to deal with this challenge. Now, the next issue that I want to respond to, Chair, is the question that it's coming twice, the issue of the fiscal cliff. Are we approaching a fiscal cliff? Now, if you were to ask me a simple question, about the credibility of the fiscal policy stance that government has adopted since the onset of the global economic crisis. If you ask me, is it credible? I would say yes, I would say it is credible. And simply put, let me just give a few details here. The primary balance, which is the gap between government revenue and non-interest spending, has been declining progressively since 2011 and is earmarked to virtually disappear by 2019 in terms of the current position that we are looking at. This means that a large element of the budget deficit is simply being applied to servicing debt, rather than being a function of general spending exceeding revenue. So we don't have a problem here of spending exceeding revenue. That's the key. So the primary budget deficit, which is excluding interest payments, is earmarked to narrow to just 11.5 billion by 2018-19. Having been as high as 77.2 billion in 2012-13. Now, if you put those figures to any rating agency, they will say that this is a positive outlook. So we're not actually looking at a fiscal cliff. Yes, we have a problem, which has been identified, by the way. There is one issue that comes with this medium-term expenditure, medium-term budget policy statement, which is a new fiscal rule, which is not exactly new, but it's part of the package of those rules that we talked about when we started the response to the crisis. Now, the initial response and assessment But with all the measures that government put in place, some of the assumptions about the challenge that South Africa was facing being of a cyclical nature have been disproved, which is why, as the Financial and Fiscal Commission, our work at that particular point in time suggested that if the global economy does not recover in the time that a normal cyclical problem would disappear, then even when it recovers, the South African economy will never return to the growth on a long-term path that we have been used to. So what we are seeing is that's what we call the worst-case scenario. And by the way, our modeling exercises don't actually do your actual projections. They take what is there, and then you do a scenario around those numbers. So we can take as many numbers as possible from the different providers of these numbers, and then we work around that to just to look at the pattern and the trend in terms of what the likely outcomes are going to be. So what we're saying is that obviously the counter-cyclical policy stance has probably run its course. That is why you needed that fiscal rule now that has been introduced to allow you to track your long-term growth trends and therefore be able to manage your expenditure along that growth trend. And that is why you are now seeing an exploration on the revenue side. So it's no longer just about cutting expenditure, because you can only cut that much. And given the kind of program that government wants to introduce in the form of your NHI rollout, your reforms to social security, and now what has turned out to be actually an even more pressing issue of free education, it becomes even more imperative that you are actually able to respond to that with a full understanding of what your growth trends are going to be in terms of the broad macro economic aggregate. And I think it then that is why in our recommendation, one of our recommendations is that we need to clarify what, in terms of the task team that has been set up to deal with this funding for public universities, we need to clarify what is meant by free education, exactly, from a policy perspective, and how do you then work your way into implementing it, because if you can't, like, wake up today and say, open the doors, so it's today is free education. It's impossible to do it that way. One would have to map out a direction and strategy to get to that. So that is why one needs to review the whole model of how we are funding universities right now. So the other thing that I wanted to respond to before I leave, and I leave the rest of the questions to the team here. I think it's the issue of I think, Honorable Mutara, you raised a number of issues relating to the grants and what is actually happening and whether the outcome. It's very difficult for me to actually say, because what we have seen are studies that planning, monitoring, and evaluation have done around some of these issues. And those, I'm sure the colleagues behind my back here would be able to respond to those questions. The team that you see at the back here, including myself, were quite central to the review of this conditional grant, and we're still having some conversations about what to do with departments when they come in, because most of these grants are not like Treasury decides. It's departments that come up with them, and so you need to then. Can we get a process that is tighter, that basically says, where do we start and how do we get to accept and agree? So I think that's all that I can say around that. Let me just leave now, and the rest of the questions, my colleagues and Professor Steichler here will respond. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thanks very much. So we'll remain with the team. I was to consider Dr. Madloka. And any other hand, just any other hand, okay. Honorable Mangoma, yes. And then, yeah, I'll recognize the four last hand. Thanks. In that order, I'll point. Thanks, Honorable.
No, thanks, Honorable Coaches. Thanks to the FCC for the good presentation as usual, and also the recommendations that they have come up with. Chair, around the issue of education, I think the issue of education is a societal matter. I agree with the recommendations that they have put forward for the government to focus in order to try and address the challenges facing our young people in the high institution of learning. But Chair, maybe one will request that maybe they must do further research. As I indicated, that it is a societal matter, so that they can come up to say that what will be the role that the government must play. They have indicated, demonstrated in the presentation. The universities, I was covered when the colleague was raising the issue of the universities, because it's like now, Honorable Imam indicated everything, government. But as society, we are now holding hands. We are doing nothing. And I think we need the leadership in the high institution of learning that is so creative, in a sense that they have come up with something also when they do that particular research to say what would be the role of universities, and also what are the cost drivers for their expenditure. Is it really focusing on the issue of transformation, or is just a business as usual? Because we really need to have a focus that will really assist going forward. And lastly, also on around the issue of the stakeholders, the private sector, to say what will be the role of the private sector coming together as a triangle, looking at what really can be the best solution for the funding of the education of our country. And also around that particular, you have raised a lot of challenges that we are facing as a country that we agree on. And the minister has indicated that if there is no economic growth, there will be no revenue growth. If there is no revenue growth, there will be no expenditure growth. So these are the challenges that we are facing. But when you go to your conclusion around those particular matters, you indicate your concern, to say that you are having a concern around the reduction of the funding education. I want to check, is there any better way that the FC thinks government must do differently to increase? I see this particular, because you have indicated the challenges that the country is facing, you know. But at the same time, you are having a concern that there is a reduction. Maybe there is a better way that maybe you can, over and above the recommendations that you made, that the government can do more better in order to fund the education. You have also indicated, also I want to check whether is there any other way that government can do differently. You indicated the issue of the concern around the issue of the reduction in the funding of infrastructure. Is there any better way that you think a government can do differently to increase and facilitate economic growth through infrastructure? Because I think the challenge that the country is facing is the issue of the recession that you have indicated, the issue of a depreciation of a rand. Whilst it is depreciated, you are expecting high imports, and then
there is a challenge that all the economies are going down and the reduction of imports also is not increasing while the rand is depreciating. But seemingly, I heard the Mr. Khumalo indicating that yes, we have to reprioritize, the government must reprioritize and also must look at the wastage and the other funds to try and do it. But do you think even if the government can reprioritize and look at that one, because we are looking at something that is sustainable, it takes me to a question, what should be a long-term sustainable funding for higher education? What is the comment about, what is the comment of the FSC about that? What do they think will assist us to have a long-term sustainable funding for the higher education? Thanks.
Thanks very much, Honorable Madropa. Can I have Honorable McLaughlin? I'm right.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, thank you. I don't have a great deal to say today. I just wanted to get your comment, if I may. Yesterday, the Parliamentary Budget Office told us that it had been estimated that Eskom's problems last year and all the, you know, the knock-on effect of all the blackouts and the load shedding and so on cost the economy approximately 1% in GDP. Now, given that background, if that had actually happened, we hadn't had the Eskom problem and our GDP would be 1% higher, obviously our situation now would be a whole lot better than it is. But now we are taking at the moment money and we're giving it to local government in grants to enable them to meet their commitments to Eskom. Now, during the course of this year, we've already written off 60 billion rand that Eskom borrowed from government, provided them with another 23 billion, or sorry, not during this year, towards the end of last year, and now we're still assisting municipalities to pay money to Eskom. It seems to me that a large amount of money from wherever it's coming from, but it's coming out of taxpayers' pockets eventually and consumers' pockets, is going to Eskom. Is it your opinion that this whole scenario is going to fix that problem? Will Eskom at the end of this be able to perform in such a way that we can expect in the future not to have our GDP knocked by 1% because of their failure to do their fundamental job? In addition, surely the relationship to any municipality in Eskom is a purely commercial one. Eskom offers electricity for sale and the municipality buys it and then sells it on at a profit, and that's how they make their money, that's how they fund a lot of their programs. But it's not happening because the municipalities are failing to collect the other monies that are due to them. That's why they are not paying the Eskom debt, because they're using the monies that they're getting from elsewhere to cover other things. Would it not be beneficial if we could somehow introduce a system or some kind of program to get municipalities to be more efficient in collecting the monies that are actually due to them? After all, it's a legal obligation they have in terms of the MFMA to collect monies that are due to them, but they just fail to do it. Now, to just keep writing it off year after year doesn't really help, because half the residents in an area will be paying their accounts and the other half won't, and nothing happens, and there's no consequence once again. And what happens in the end is those members of our country or taxpayers are footing the bill once again, whether they've used the current or not. Now they're indirectly paying for the electricity for those who haven't paid. So basically that's the only question I have. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much, Honourable Member. Honourable Mongom.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Or honourable members, may I thank the Financial and Fiscal Commission for the input which they have given us. And I must honestly state, Chairperson, that I have not read their previous annual reports or some of their major reports, but I keep an eye on what they've been doing. But the first area which I would like to address is how the Chairperson responded to a matter which was addressed where one of our members wanted to know what is actually happening with the type of recommendations they keep coming with year in, year out. Then I started chatting to my colleague sitting on my left about our oversight responsibility. Chairpersons, I would like to state that most of the issues which we seem to be asking the commission to do for us, it's something which we need to be doing as our oversight function, every little bit. We need to be doing it. We're asking them questions, what needs to be happened to this? Can they make a follow-up on this? It is not their responsibility. It is our responsibility. We need to ensure that the cycle of oversight, which we have the responsibility to do, is actually fulfilled, where there isn't a break in the oversight. I would like to take note of a few areas of recommendations which they've done, which they've actually given to this committee and which they are giving today, and which if we don't do our work well as members in seeing that when we receive these reports, what actually happens to a recommendation, we will be seeing them again. I would like to start with the first one here, where they are saying working with state-owned entities to develop and implement realistic turnaround strategies. What we would like to find out here as members, ourselves, on our own, with our research units, not actually giving the function back to them, is actually to say to ourselves, what type of realistic turnaround plans are in place? And then we use the system and the powers that we have as Parliament to actually ensure that this happens. I don't want us to shift the responsibility to them if it's actually a responsibility to us. The issue of another recommendation which I do take note of and which I do know that is also our responsibility is a recommendation on where they are saying raising job creation potential and addressing the skills mismatch issue is important. It's not also their responsibility. They have put it forth as a recommendation to us. It's us who need to follow it up to see to it that the department of higher learning or whatever, they actually look at this issue quite well. May I also address the issue of what they've also done, and they've done it many times and from many quarters, and that is a matter which Honorable Sheikh Imam also addressed. That is the funding of housing delivery, which is fiscally unsustainable. This is what they have said. We've known about that for ages. Even Honorable Paul Mashatile, when he was the MEC of housing in Gauteng, when I was in Gauteng, was sitting with this matter. It means that we need to restructure our oversight so that when we say to them, yes, you have given us a recommendation, this is how we will go with it. We don't have to keep shifting the goal. They've actually spoken about the issue of HIV/AIDS, which I definitely agree with, especially the aspect of TB. And thank you for your kind words when you have actually said that, I think you said the commission notes the expansion of the grant to cover tuberculosis. The commission supports this as long as new priorities. I think that is where we need to find out what are these new priorities so that when we interact with the Department of Health, we doing our oversight, we need to ensure that all of that is actually done. And lastly, Chairperson, on an issue which I also just wanted to address is the matter of, if you may excuse me, is the matter of the local government, where other LG issues, where it says that there's also some local municipalities or municipalities that are ignoring agreements. Again, that's our oversight matter. We need to ensure that they do that. Although finally, Chair, in my input, I would like to state that it would assist us if the report from the Commission would finally address specific recommendations to specific departments, so that you don't need to go to slide so-and-so to pick up an issue on this department and another one on that department. So that when we actually go on our oversight function or using our oversight model, we do know that in the Department of Housing, there's 10 recommendations which are stated in this fashion. In the Department of maybe finance, there's 15 recommendations. I think that would assist us. But all in all, Chairperson, I think we need to revisit our oversight responsibility, because this is how this report will be changed next year if we do our part. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable. Can I give to Honorable Shobe Sitole?
Thank you very much, Chairperson, for the opportunity. I'm so excited today because Mankoma is just speaking as if she was reading my mind. The Constitution of the Republic of South Africa puts the responsibility of oversight on the legislature. You know, the first president of the USA had this to say, that people will not account unless they are made to account. That is why in our constitution we have got that responsibility. As far as I'm concerned, government has been doing what it's supposed to do. But I'm not sure whether as legislatures we have been doing what we are supposed to do. For instance, on the issue of infrastructure spending, which we know very well that it is the type of spending that can create the necessary jobs. I don't think we give ourselves enough time to actually oversee that spending, actually go on the ground and see what is happening. For instance, in municipalities, you find that there is a contractor on site. You find bricks all over the show, standing there for weeks on end, and nobody is worried about it. And that is a waste. And I think we should do what we decided last week, Chairperson Mashatile, at our workshop, to reduce our days in the house and put more time on the oversight so that we actually follow the money. We cannot allocate money and just allow it to be used willy-nilly. I think that is something that our chairpersons are going to take forward to the leadership of this institution. We need more time to spend more time on actually overseeing the spending of money, especially in infrastructure projects. On the issue of the universities, Chairperson, I would humbly request that as a committee we actually ask for a research on the wasteful and fruitless expenditure which universities of this country have engaged in, producing useless skills. Because we have got a lot of certificated or gowned people around, but they are not helpful to producing jobs for the country. And as far as I'm concerned, that is fruitless and wasteful expenditure. And we need to make a research and have it documented. You know, Chairperson, in the last term, we had a course with the University of the Western Cape University under Professor Ben Churok. I remember when we were dealing with linkages, he actually said, you know, our problem is that we are not linking our efforts as private sector, government, and universities. Universities are doing what they want. They don't care. He actually used this word. They don't care what government is saying. They don't care what the president says. They don't care what the mandate is saying. They do what they want. And unfortunately, it is done at the cost of the taxpayer. It is the taxpayer that is funding the universities to produce unskilled people. So I think as this committee, we need to have a research and have a document so that we can see how much South Africa has wasted funding these universities. We need to have that document. And as far as my friend, my learned friend, you know, my friend we're coming together now. Because you're seeing the cliff, the fiscal cliff, and we must stop the cliff. If there's a cliff, it means we must start working together. We must stop wasting time in the legislature politicking. We must hold each other's hand, all the parties, and make sure that government is delivering. And go on site and check performance. And actually monitor the reports of the Auditor General. The reports, the recommendations of the, because the Auditor General takes efforts to actually tell us what is, we can't come here and be surprised when the Auditor General is issuing reports all the time. Thank you so much to the Finance and Fiscal Commission. You have been our advisor. You must continue to advise us. I don't think you have got any responsibility. As Honorable Nkomo has said, the court is in, the ball is in our court. And I can tell you, we are equal to the task. We are going to find solutions for this country. We will not throw our hands in the air. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Honorable Member. Prof, I'm going to give to you to respond to questions. But I just want to raise one thing about the framework that is tabled by the minister. I think the question has been asked, but I want to raise it this way. Does the current fiscal policy support industrial development, if we are to put it much more clearer? That I'm simply saying allocations, current allocations, as we move forward preparing for the budget, the allocations, those support is industrial development. I'm raising this because we admit that domestically and globally the economy is faced with challenges, and countries in the world do discuss or make changes in the structure of the economies. So the issue of competitive and comparative advantage. Does South Africa in a position really to advance some of the agenda that we talk about? If we are to substitute imports with local products, we have raised a number of issues which are constraining factors. But where are we? Thanks. And then Honorable Mashatile is going to close, to do the closing remark. But I think the point is noted of members that there is a greater role of the Appropriations Committee, especially under the current situation. Budgets should be linked to economic transformation agenda. I think that point, we have to be much more assertive in prominently placing the role of the Appropriation Committee, linking budget as an instrument to advance economic transformation. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think let me reiterate and thank Honorable Nkomo about the actually clear way that you expressed it. The FHC is only valued to the advice that we give, and that advice is based, and you'll accept it or reject it, on the basis of good research based on actual data. And we cannot implement it. We're not an implementing body. We are simply there as a resource for government, and particularly for Parliament, and as the Chairperson said, we are reporting to you, and it is, I think, what Toby correctly said, the ball is in your court to say, well, here are the recommendations. What I do like about your suggestion is a much clearer indication of who do we are addressing for. It is not only for the Treasury in terms of division of revenue bill, but a whole host of other departments, and that we can do that much more clearly. And so, well, these are to the Department of Higher Education and Training, and or these are to the Department of Labour, whatever the case may be. So I think we should take that on board. The other point of caution I must also express in terms of the FSC is we're a small organisation. We are about, I mean, 12 researchers. And we should be careful not to be jack of all trades and master of none and trying to give advice when we are not the experts on public employment projects, and to say, well, what is the best way of doing so? We have to do what we can and be very clear that we do not stray in areas that we are not the experts. We can not come forward and say we have the magic bullet which is going to transform the economy. We have made suggestions about how the economy in general would better perform, particularly the private sector, and those remarks were made earlier on. Let me just then just a few remarks on higher education, particularly being in higher education. Clearly, it's a tripartite institution. The universities themselves, private sector, the parents, the community, and then the state. It's a public product that we produce, education certificates, whether they are wasteful or not, one obviously would have discussions, debates about it, and it's a question from what side you're looking at what is wasteful or what is not. I remember way back in the early 90s, the then Minister of Finances and looked at my university, UWC, why do you have a Department of Religious Studies? That's now really wasteful. And the professor turned around and said, well, what about the moral values and matters that are discussed? They are valuable in gold in terms of a moral fiber that is there. Do you want to tell me that you only want your accountants and no persons that can speak on moral values? And so it's a debate which I think one can have is whether there's a wasteful skills. It's debatable. In terms of what universities are bringing to the party, they are engines of competition, they are engines of innovation. And what has these policies meant so far is that these institutions are not simply government departments that follow rules, they are innovative. And speaking from my own university is how an institution could transform itself with limited resources from a HDI status to a national university, to an international university, by good leadership, by the ability to have a level of autonomy where you could go out and raise significant amounts of money overseas and from the private sector. So the whole debate, and I'm sorry to say that much of the debate is, well, one should distinguish between academic freedom and university autonomy. And the one is fine, academic freedom, we're not going to touch that, but autonomy, let's rein that in. The question to my mind is that university autonomy has been able to give scope for academic freedom, to lead to innovation, and to produce excellent results. Just on those few notes, let me go ask my colleagues to answer particular questions, and if there's not, I will try to capture them at the end. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. I'll try and talk to questions or comments on the local government. The first issue was about the measure of these grants, which was raised by the honourable member there. What we are saying here is there are some grants which are missed because they are non-performing, and we are saying that's not the solution if there is such a thing, those grants. But the grants I pointed out, especially under the local government infrastructure review, what are these major water grants? Sanitation grants. We are saying it's a noble move because these municipalities were getting grants for all of us, five from different grant streams. Then it increased their reporting. It also stressed them when it comes to administering these particular grants. So we are saying the major consolidation of these grants is a good thing which must be continued. We started talking about this in around 2012, that there's a need for the measure of some of these grants which are duplicating activities. It will lessen the burden to municipalities. So it is in that particular context that we are welcoming this measure of these particular grants which are proliferating. Then there's the issue about conditional grants, whether they have achieved their desired outcomes. The issue, we have seen that in the past, for example, the local government equitable share.
is moving resources to poorer municipalities, which is a good thing, especially rural municipalities. But the question goes further, and that's the question we are asking ourselves, which will be coming in the following submission. Are these grants effective in achieving their intended intended objectives? I think that's where your question is, and we are focusing on that to look at the effectiveness of these grants, especially in rural municipalities. Are they achieving the intended objectives? Then there was a question on the on whether the withdrawal of the local government share to some municipalities, are there any lessons we have learned for that? First, I think the picture is mixed. We know that there are some municipalities which have not honored this particular agreement, but on the whole, a number of municipalities, quite a significant number of municipalities, have paid some of their monies they were owing to ESCOM. And what subsequently, I think we made that presentation here some time ago, and subsequently what has happened is that we have seen that National Treasury has also put some pressure to provincial governments as well as national governments to also pay municipalities what they owe municipalities. So I think the process as it is evolving is quite yielding some positive results, because also municipalities are getting what they were owed. Then there was a question on whether it would be beneficial to have a program whereby municipalities improve their efficiencies. Yes, there are programs to that. There are programs which are designed to improve the capacity of municipalities. There are institutions which are assisting that, COPTA, National Treasury, etc. There are some programs to assist municipalities to improve in that support, direct and indirect interventions. But I think some of them we need at some point to assess whether these programs are effective in improving the efficiency of municipalities. Yeah, those are the questions on the local government. So Talib will tackle some of the questions.
Yes, I'd just like to respond to the question that was raised by one of the members regarding the reduction in funding to infrastructure. And is there a better way of improving funding of infrastructure? And I think this was also an issue that the member raised with respect to education as well. I think there's a few options that government have. Now, the first option, which would allow the least amount of hurt to the economy, is to try and find ways to get the economy going again and to boost economic growth, which all of us agree is something that has been confronting the government for the past few years. Now, there are two areas that we need to consider. The one aspect is that there are certain issues or certain factors that impact economic growth that is outside the control of government. For example, what happens in the EU, what happens in other countries. But there are certain areas that are within the control of government, and some of those issues have been raised already. The issue with ESCOM, with labor unrest and other such factors that have a negative impact on economic growth. So those factors that we can control are factors or issues that, if we can get a handle on that, can mitigate or at least protect a further reduction in economic growth of the country. The second option is to reconsider the expenditure ceiling that the government, which is a current policy of government. The likely implication of that is that your debt to GDP ratio is likely to increase. And the problem with that is that that may be a major issue for your rating agencies that may see that as an area that could be a risk factor to the fiscus. Now, another area which government is currently exploring is the issue of efficiency gains. Now, there are a huge amount of inefficiencies in the system. take, for example, the area of procurement. In 2015 alone, 190 billion rand has been spent on, or has been allocated for the procurement of goods and services. 190 billion rand. Now, the establishment of the Office of the Procurement, the Office of the Public Procurement, is a way of trying to find ways in which we can actually utilize and spend that money better and actually achieve value for money, as well as the reduction in growth. So the most, so while trying to find different ways in making up the shortfall would probably be the best option. Areas that can be explored, and something which we've been reiterating all the time, is trying to find ways of achieving efficiency gains. In different areas and sectors of government, there's a lot of overlap which we see in the three spheres. And perhaps there's a serious need to look at the whole system and to identify where the where those overlaps actually exist and where we can actually streamline and try to provide services in a much more coordinated fashion.
Thanks. Well,
okay, just to speak to the last question with respect to the current industrial development allocations as well as imports substitution. Now, one would ideally want government to spend an increasing amount in areas that is going to bring some kind of economic return to economic growth. And of course, an area that, one of the areas that is in the, that has been identified in the budget is on industrial development. Now, while there has been allocations that have gone to industrial development, the question that we need to ask ourselves is, what can be done to improve that? And are there areas that are currently being allocated to industrial development that can be utilized in a much more strategic way? Now, it's not specifically an area that the FSC has really done a lot of work in, but it's one of those, if you like, economic growth factors that we need to take into consideration as part of our overall growth strategy going forward. But I'll just hand over to Prof.
If there are any other specific ones that we've missed that has more generalities that we can speak on, because obviously broad matters, everyone agrees, better management of resources that we have, less corruption, better management of state-owned enterprises, all these are just everything knows and agrees on it, and so little value there for us to repeat it. But I realize that then it's done at the moment. Thank you.
Honorable members, let me thank on your behalf the FSC and National Treasury. Want to say anything? No? You've taken serious notes. That's very good. Let's thank the FSC. I think they've given us a lot of good ideas, options, particularly on the burning issue of how we fund higher education in a sustainable way. Next week, Wednesday, we will engage directly with the Portfolio Committee on Higher Education and the department. I think all members are very interested on how do we resolve this matter, both in the short term and the long term. Of course, the issues of reprioritization may not just be limited to the Department of Higher Education. It may need a lot of a broader perspective than that. But I think the process will help us as we engage. We will be having public hearings and getting a lot of ideas. But Prof and your team, thank you very much. If we need more stuff, we will contact you. Thank you very much, Honorable Members. The meeting is adjourned.